Okay. Hello. So today is an awkward lecture because this is the last lecture before the midterm review, and the midterm review is then before the midterm because the midterm review is the Wednesday after Thanksgiving, and the Monday after that is a midterm. So you still have a good amount of time for the midterm, but I don't have any more lectures. So my choice today is either to, and I don't feel like presenting any more material for going on the test, because I've already given you assignment one and assignment two. That's the core of the test. Basically, that is the base material of the test. A few little maybe conceptual things, but basically, if you really understand those two assignments, you understand what you need to do for the test. So I'm at a little bit of a dilemma. It's like, I can repeat myself, talk in more detail about those things, or I can talk about material that's not going to be in the test. That will be on the final. It's not material that I shouldn't be covering, but it's moving ahead. And so, it's really a question of what you all want to ask me. Because if you all come to me now and say you don't have any questions, then I will go on and talk about other things that are not going to be on the midterm. Or you ask me questions and we can talk about things that will be on the midterm. Because you now have seen assignment one and assignment two. You know roughly what's kind of there. On next Wednesday, what I will do is I will go through a specific study guide. We'll have specific topics, and I'm planning on doing a more detailed review on Wednesday. So I'm expecting to spend some amount of time today covering new material. But it all depends on what you all ask me, because the environment diagrams I talked about last time, I think, may have helped clarify things. I don't know, and I could go over those some more detail. But we'll go over again anything that we discussed in more detail. So, what? Sure. Let me bring up the assignment here so I can see it. Of course, after I moved up the screen, that always happens. But I don't know if I can read it. But go ahead and read to it while I log in.
So, part A, question three: how can I change the port node listens on without changing the code? Not changing the code at all, like not touching the code.
Not touching the code.
Okay.
So, how is that possible? So that is a good question. And let's go to the, I will put on, no, I don't have my point. Computer, and okay, we are looking at assignments, assignment two. What I want to look at is, so what you're looking at is, let's look at, what did I just do that with? Did it just execute that as like a JavaScript file?
Yep.
How annoying.
How insecure.
Yes. Okay, yeah, I don't, what execution context did it run that? I don't know. open with. Those are the only options? Seems a little heavyweight. Let's see what Visual Studio thinks of this thing. Has anyone tried opening up JavaScript in Visual Studio? Let's see this thing chug, chug, chug. And there we go. Not bad. Okay, so this is the core. I'll tell you the answer to the solution is here. So notice, in this version of the application, let's zoom in the code. This is too small. That good? So you'll notice in this version of the code, it says HTTP create server app listen app get port function, whatever. So app get port, the port property of the app object, is what's going to tell us what port to use. We set that up here, right? So it says app set port, and then it gives this OR value. It says process env port OR 3000. So what does this imply that the answer is? Some, you don't have to understand it completely, but...
I mean, we have to change the process environment.
Yes, process env port, you have to change the value of that. If that value is non-zero, you'll set that port. Simple enough. So the next question is, what the heck is that variable? Any thoughts? So you set environment variable, so that is in fact what it is. Did you cover environment variables in your C course in 2401? Some yes, some no. So, in Unix systems, and I believe you can also do this trick in Windows, but you can definitely do this in your Ubuntu environment, there are various variables that are defined for processes. Now, these variables, now there are two kinds of variables in Unix, if you're kind of like in a command line. One is shell variables, and the other is environment variables. Shell variables are only for shells, i.e. for your bash, for your CSH, or whatever. They're specific to the shell. Basically, they're almost like variables in any programming language. You could make a Python shell or make a JavaScript shell, and it would have its own local variables. Environment variables are something that is controlled by Unix, by the kernel. So did you all learn execve? How many of you have heard of execve? How many of you have not? Okay. This is one of those pieces that you hopefully will learn at some point. Ideally, maybe I'll have to cover that here. Normally it's covered in operating system, but really it needs to be covered in second year. So what, when you start up a new process in Unix, there's two things you do. One is you call fork, and the other is call execve. Fork duplicates the current process. Execve loads a new program binary. Execve takes three arguments. The arguments it takes, one is program binary, i.e. the path to the program you want to run. Now, whatever this binary is, it's going to overwrite the current process. So that's why you first do fork, you duplicate the process, and then you overwrite the current process. Now, you might think this sounds rather inefficient because duplicating the process isn't that expensive. Turns out it's not, because of the way there are certain tricks that are done. But, so first thing you have is program binary. The second thing you have is command line arguments. So when you type node app.js, app.js, actually the name node too, are all command line arguments, and there includes parameters as part of the execve call. But there is a third option, which is environment variables. Environment variables, it's key value pairs. It's the variable name, the variable value. And there are some limits on them, although in newer Unixes can have a lot of environment variables, but the idea is that this is state that is passed to the process, right, passed to the running program. Normally, the environment variables are inherited from parent processes to children processes. So when you start a new process, you pass on its environment variables, and you normally pass on the environment variables that were given to you. So, if I go, probably the best way I should do this is maybe run PuTTY. So, actually, no, we can go to. Yes. So, this is actually a machine you can. Okay, so. Can you see that at all? Is that vaguely real in the back? Eh. Okay, well, I'm not going to show much. But the main thing to know is, so if I type env outputs all of the environment variables that the current shell has. So by default, these are all passed on to the next process. So things like user, if you look in here, you'll see things like the user is Soma, my login name was Soma, my home directory is home 4 user 5 Soma, my path, which is the directories that are searched for finding binaries, is this. Oh, my mail spool is here. The shell I'm using is CSH. Oh, that's so wrong. So this SSH client, so since I SSH'd in, it sets environment variables time of my SSH connection. There's all these things that are useful to various programs. Oh, LS colors. These are telling the colors for the terminal. You know, for LS. Yeah. But anyway, environment variables. So if you, all of these are accessible in Node through the process env object. All of those variables that you see at the shell prompt, when you run Node, should be accessible. Well, it's whatever the shell decided to pass on when it created, when it ran the Node process. But it'll basically pass on all of these. So you can access all of them as part of the process env object. They're all just properties of it. And they're normally by convention, environment variables are uppercase. And so that's why it's dot port in all uppercase. So if I can set an environment variable here of the appropriate port number, it will be passed on to the Node process, and it will see it there, and thus you'll get it. So if you're doing this in the Lubuntu environment, the default shell is bash. And so the syntax for setting this is you say export port equals, and then you give the number, like 5,000. And then if you next ran node, now of course the name port's kind of funny. Maybe it should be like node port. But, well, they decided. By default, it's port. So if you do this, export port equals 5,000, and then run node, it would run on port 5,000. If you're doing this in CSH right here, this gives you an error because it doesn't know the export because we're in CSH, and so this is set env port 5000. And you'll notice now the very bottom line here, I have a port equal to 5000. But that's CSH. Don't use CSH. If you did the equivalent command, this export port equals to 5000, it'll work. So, I would accept a value of you just need to change the process env port value. But if you looked up this process env structure, you should learn that it means environment variables and say it. But really, this is very convenient because think about it. This way, you can take the same program and run multiple copies of Node without changing the code on your system. You know, you set up in one shell, you set the port property to 3001, another one set it to 3002, another one set it to 3003. You've got three Node processes, all potentially using the same code. So, longer answer than you're probably expecting, but does that seem clear? Questions?
Very clear. For the top of the assignment,
mm-hmm.
in the description, it says questions requiring code changes indicate what parts of the program were changed in your answers file and made the changes directly to the code.
Yep.
What does that last sentence?
Make direct changes directly to the code?
Yeah.
The idea is that you're supposed to submit a modified version of session demo.
In assignment one, we didn't have to do that, right?
No, you did not have to do that. You were not specifically not supposed to do that for assignment one. For assignment two, you're having to write more code. So I've asked you to include a zip file.
So if for question three, you ask me to do something that will require me to change the code, do you want me to change...
So if you look at this, I'll tell you what parts... So you questions one through five, you should be just answering in the answers file. Question six, modify the code so it keeps track of how many times an user is logged in. Modify it modify the source code files directly and just tell in the answer in the answers file, just say, I modified these files like this. And the same thing for seven, modify the code so that sessions are authenticated. This is a good bit more code. Again, put that in, just made the changes to it, but here just summarize what you did. Yes?
Question six, do you have to really actually like visually show the user how many times they've logged in? Or is it in the code?
I didn't actually say that, did I? I just said you had to keep track of it. That was the reason I didn't finalize it. Because I knew there were a few bugs like this in there. So let me change that. What I was having in my mind was that you would show beside each user a little number that would say how many times they're logged in. You know, like one session, two sessions, three sessions. I assume that shouldn't be too much harder to do once you figure out how to do this. Okay? Let's see if I can go ahead and log in. Nope. Okay. So here, how do you use it? Output the number of sessions for a user in the / users page. Twice, it should say do not include the count if the user is only logged in once. How's that? So that way you can just, because otherwise it would look kind of stupid saying one session. You know, if everyone says one session beside them, I hate, it's like if they're logged in twice or three times, it says two sessions, three sessions, otherwise you just have a list of users. Okay? Also helps with the hook button. Further questions? Yes?
When you submit the grade stream assignment, are you going to submit the real answers?
What do you mean submit the grades?
Are you going to put what the answers for the assignment are?
I've put up the answers for assignment one already.
Really?
Oh. Yeah, I did. I talked about it in the last class.
I didn't come.
That would be why. So I didn't put up the answers to part A of assignment one.
Yeah, that one.
Because, you have an interpreter. You can do it. I will talk to Michael Day and put it up there, but it just seemed not particularly interesting for reference. There was a question. So I will go through the one thing is the assignment two is due next Wednesday. So it's good to ask your questions about assignment two now because it's due next Wednesday because I'm going to go over the answers next Wednesday because the material from assignment two is going to be on the midterm. So it makes sense for me to go through the answers before the midterm. So that will be a key part of the next lecture. Behind you, yes?
Wednesday, what time?
No, I mean, if you look, it should be in Web CT. It should say it's due at like 2 or 2.30, like right before class. Because I come into class, I'm going to show the answers, and I'm going to, of course, if I've talked about them in class, I'll post them online. Otherwise, you'd go home and just put the answers in after I've told you them. I mean, it's not so much because I know some people will potentially like say, oh, I couldn't do it, I'm late or something. I can be persuaded or something, but really, you should do it before that time because otherwise it doesn't help you if I talk about the answers. If I just tell you the answers, that's not nearly as good as you having tried to do it, and then I tell you the answers. Basic teaching strategy. So, try to do the answers. Yes?
You were talking about the midterm review is next week.
Yep.
And you asked if we wanted you to speak about it. I thought that maybe if you could just say what sections would be covered in the midterm reviews next week.
Assignment one and assignment two.
Oh, that's just it. Nothing else.
Basically, the way I believe in doing midterms and tests in general is I think of the lectures as providing support for doing the assignments. And I see the assignments as providing a template for the exams. So, because that way you have an idea what to study. But now, I'm not going to give you, I will tell you, I am a big believer in recycling. So there will be significant similarities between the midterm and the assignments you have done. But they will not be identical by any means. There will be changes, though. It might even be some new stuff or something. But you should be able to draw a connection from the assignments, you know, and basically get most of it. I mean, there might be some small little things, but, you know, that's the material. Yes?
On your homepage, it said by the time assignment two is due, we have to decide if we're going to do, like, a project or continue with the assignments.
Right. I had forgotten completely about that thing. No. So,
what does that mean?
So one option I had talked about early, you know, beginning of the class was that for some of you who feel like these assignments are boring you out of your skull, you want to actually use Node to do something real, you have to talk to me and form a team. And, you know, form a team or be individual and you can do something more interesting. And that, and the grade, you, instead of getting grades for assignment 3 and 4, you'll get a project grade. And I might even change the weighting of it if you, you know, depending on how you do your project relative to the other parts of the class. But that is, I want to hear the project proposal, you have to talk to me. So let's say, so the midterm is on Monday. On Monday, like the 23rd, let's say I would want to have project proposals by that Wednesday.
So you know, like, come to you with an idea?
Yes. You have to come to me with an idea. I'm not coming up with templates, this is a project you can do, this is a project you can do. No. Because the whole point of the project idea is you have an idea, you have something cool you want to build, and then you talk to me about it. Because... And it's really, this is just aimed for the students who are doing the assignments and going like, this is easy. This is no problem. I've already spent the past 5 years doing web development. This Node stuff is no big deal. I'm getting bored. I don't want you to be bored. I want to give you something interesting to do. So I'll let you do a project instead of wasting your time with assignments. So... By that point, I will have your grade for assignment one and assignment two. I'll expect you to have aced assignment one and assignment two. And I potentially can look at your midterm. And it's like, basically, if you're doing well in the class, I say, okay, here you go. You can do a project. So basically by that Wednesday, you don't necessarily tell me exactly what you can do, but you tell me you're doing a project. And you can just send me an email saying, I want to do a project. Remind me, I can post something to the class bulletin board about saying that, you know, about this procedure, but I'm not expecting many projects. I really am not. So Michael has graded about half the assignment ones, and he said that, you know, he should be done the next day or so with the rest of assignment one. And he told me something kind of worrisome, which is that he's finding grades are kind of bimodal on the assignment, which means he's seeing some people who haven't even done parts B and C in the assignment. Or seeing people have major problems with them, or say leaving big portions blank. So you got this. I'm hoping that he's like this. He just got some of the bad ones, and he grades more, that'll be better distributed. But that's very worrisome for me, because if you haven't taken the time to actually do the assignment, I don't see how you're going to do well on the tests. But for those of you who are in the, you know, getting 85% and better on these assignments and then do well on the tests, then yeah, I don't need to sit here and walk you through all the details with Node. You know what you're doing. Go do something fun. So, yeah. And don't worry, if you do a project with, if you actually step up and do a project and actually do something interesting, you'll get a good grade. The only way you won't get a good grade is if you just slack off. But I mean, basically, if you do a reasonable project, you're basically getting an A. But you're probably already going to get an A if you're on the project path. This is the project path for you to do something worth your time. That help? But yeah, I had completely forgotten about it. I was so focused on the assignment. So, oh yeah, I said you could do a project. Other questions? You ask me questions about the assignment. That's great. I'm happy to go through things. Yes?
For part B, we are the questions 1 to 15
cumulative,
because number 3 and number 10 are the same thing.
Yes. Yeah, so notice, assume the answers are expressions are entered into the interpreter as ordered. In other words, the early expression may influence the later ones. If you get an error, report the kind of error, a reference error, a type error. So yes, Y is here. Y is here. Do they have the same value here as 3 and 10? Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know. That is for you to determine. Now again, there is an easy way to do this part, and there's the right way of doing this part. If you do the easy way, you're setting yourself up to fail a big chunk of the test. Because
what's the easy way?
Enter it into the interpreter.
What's the hard way?
Write down the answers, try to figure out the answers, and then run it to the interpreter. Check your results. In other words, anyone turning this in, if you don't get 100% for this part, you're an idiot. You know? You're just an idiot. I'm sorry, I will just say that. Come on. But it's an exercise. It's an exercise. You're supposed to sit there and try to figure this out. Why are these things here? If you have a good mental model for why these answers are coming out, this is great. Now, I can't just sit here and make up questions for you, you know, on demand. These are the questions I've made up for you to try to figure out. If you waste them and just look at the answers without having actually thought through them, you've taken away a key learning thing, and you'll have to, you won't necessarily get those concepts. So, don't, you know, it's like, you know, in your math textbooks, where there's answers in the back for a lot of the questions, and you sit there and just look at the answers, okay, you've got the answer, it's like, work it out. I'm trying to help you, but you know, this is university. You got to help yourself. So again, I regard the assignments. You can collaborate with others. You can sit there and use an interpreter and stuff. There, you should be getting good grades in your assignments. there is really, I see no excuse for you all getting anything, you know, less than 80% or something on assignments. If you're getting less than that, you haven't been talking to your friends. You haven't been getting help. You weren't doing anything. You haven't taken the time. But just because you get a great grade on the assignment doesn't mean I believe you've learned it. That's what the tests are for. So. Okay. Question? No. Otherwise, I'm going to move on. Okay. Okay.
In part A, for number 4, you mentioned in 2 web browsers, we probably went through this through the tutorial, but I just want to clarify if it's 2 different web browsers, or can it be the same in 2 windows?
Ah! So, here's a question. What's the difference between 2 windows for the same web browser versus 2 separate web browsers? There's something. So first off, how is the state? When we say a person is logged in, how does your web server know you're logged in?
Are we talking about cookies now?
Yes, we are talking about cookies. Yes, cookies. The idea is there's a cookie stored in the browser that is sent to the server on each request. If you have separate windows for the same browser, do they have separate cookie stores, or do they have a unified cookie store? Unified. One cookie store. Same browser. What I'm really saying is use 2 separate cookie stores. When I say 2 browsers. So you have to, so that's why I say 2, like run Firefox and Chrome, because they do not share cookies. You could also do Firefox on 2 separate computers, because they don't share cookies. One way you could easily do it on your mesh systems is you could do Firefox in a VM and outside the VM, except then you have the problem of how does the Firefox outside the VM access node, which I have not discussed how to get past the firewall and stuff, so use Firefox and Chrome. It's easier. But that's the idea, is that you have 2 cookie stores.
I couldn't find Firefox in the Ubuntu.
What?
Okay, I guess it's in there.
Okay, if you did not see it, that implies to me you installed Lubuntu from scratch. Lubuntu from scratch is not the Lubuntu I have for download from my website. I have it significantly customized. In particular, I installed Firefox, I installed Node, and I set up some scripts. So,
do I get it through like accessories?
It should say where, when you see it in the menu, where you see Chromium, you should see Firefox.
I only have Chrome.
Where did you get your installation?
Oh, this is like in the lab.
No.
Like start menu thing, yeah. Internet, and then it should be Firefox right there, not just on the little taskbar quick launch thingy.
Yeah, it's not in the quick launch, that's true. Yeah, Firefox is not in the quick launch. You have to go to the menu.
Okay, so I guess I have Firefox.
I hope you have Firefox. So if there's something that's like, the whole point is a uniform environment for all these. Anyway, yes.
I guess also with respect to the question about number 4,
mm-hmm.
What happens if you use the incognito mode? And you don't store any cookies.
Well, incognito does store cookies.
Oh, but they're temporary for the session?
Exactly. Otherwise, in incognito mode, you could never log into any website. So it does not refuse all cookies. So you're right. Incognito mode is another way you could get a separate cookie store. But if you're interested, you have to experiment with that. You know, connect to the. You could probably connect. You should be able to connect to your Node application in incognito mode or privacy mode, and outside of it, and you should get 2 separate things. Although I think the cookie store is shared across all incognito sessions, because otherwise, yeah. Otherwise, you get some weirdnesses with you have multiple tabs and things. Do you all understand what I'm talking about by a cookie store? I mean, you have cookies. The cookies are stored in a... Traditionally, the cookies were stored in a cookies.txt file. I don't know if current browsers actually store it in cookies.txt, but they used to. in your profile. And so the idea with a separate cookie store is you have separate cookies.txt files. And with incognito mode, it would be an ephemeral one. Good questions. But you all understand what happens. Do you all intuitively understand what happens here? You should be able to work out before even trying to run this what happens.
Yeah, the sessions are numbered. So you get two sessions if you open it on one, and two on the other if you open it two times. They don't add up.
No. The problem is you, if you look at the code, this is why you have to change the code. Because the original version of the code does not keep track of how many times you're logged in. It's just you're logged in or not. So you can have separate sessions. But the sessions, Node does its thing. It keeps track of the sessions separately perfectly well. But when you store the usernames, you're not doing this. So what you will actually have, what will happen is you log into one, you see your username there. You log into the second one, you still see one user there. Then you log out of this one. In the other one, if you refresh, it will say no one's logged in. But you're logged in. Because it did the deletion, it removed the name from the property, but you still have an active session. Because it didn't keep track of account. So basically there's a bug. And that's what you're supposed to fix in question 6. Let's fix the bug. Does it all make sense?
Mm-hmm. I don't see how by outputting the number of sessions that's going to fix the bug.
You're going to have to make it track the number of sessions and then start outputting how many sessions it has. It registered.
Exactly.
Right now, it doesn't even know how many sessions you have. That's the bug. You have to make it actually, I have to figure out how many sessions it has.
So when you log in, you'll have one count. Basically, you're doing reference counting on the number of sessions. You're doing say, okay, the user logged in. Okay, now it's one. Okay, now two. And then when someone logs out, you decrement it. And when you decrement to zero, oh, the user's not logged in at all. Now let's get rid of the name from the list. That's how you should be implementing that. So the easiest way to associate this is when you put, the way it's set up is you put a property in the object. So you add counts to the properties. Okay? Not supposed to be hard. But you'll have to understand all the key thing about this course is every little concept on its own is actually pretty darn simple. It's when you put them all together that things get complicated. So, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to pause for a couple of minutes, and then after this, I'm going to start covering new material. And if you feel like your brain is going to explode if you hear anything new, you can probably run away and listen to this later. But what I want to talk about is client-side JavaScript, because I think that may actually help complement what you're doing and actually explain a little bit more about what you're seeing in this, because there is client-side JavaScript in this application, which we have not discussed. So. Okay, let's go ahead and get started again. So if you look, so this file here, this is layout.j. So this is in one of the views in session demo. Now this looks a little different than the ones we've seen in the past. In particular, so it does have the style sheet style.css, but it also has these two other lines which weren't present before. The first one is jQuery.min.js and bootstrap.min.css. Now, first, it's useful to look at those files. So what this is saying is you need to load, it's saying to load these files into the application. Well, with this one, it's script means this is going to be included in the JavaScript environment, and this is a style sheet to be referenced. the browser will use. Now if we go here and we look at, so this is saying in public, remember in public we basically have a static web server. And so the client can access anything by URLs, relative URLs that are in here. So this is libs, jQuery, jQuery.min.js. So we go to libs, jQuery, jQuery.min.js. So let's look at this. This you should be frightened by. Ooh. Think you can read that code? I don't want to read that code. So this is JavaScript code. This is the JavaScript code for jQuery. Question one, what happened to it? This is called minified code. So what do you think they did when they minified it? What does it look like? Huh? They removed every non-essential character. All comments are stripped. All spaces are stripped. All line breaks are stripped. All unnecessary characters removed. Now the next question is, why? Why is it minified?
Much quicker to load.
It's quicker to load. You've removed the unnecessary characters. It's a smaller file. It's thus smaller to transfer, and thus faster. So this is a classic trick in JavaScript on the web. Is client-side JavaScript is typically minified. It's also compressed oftentimes. That further reduces it, but it's always nice if you compress something that's already small, you know, because it's just less characters to take. Although, I've not actually seen the comparisons of minified versus non-minified code, how much space it takes up, because the one thing this definitely does remove is comments, and that's something you wouldn't be able to get rid of just by compression. So I'm not actually sure how much minification does. If you assume the web server is setting the content down compressed, which a lot of web servers do, I don't know how much the benefit is. But as a culture thing, you will often see minified JavaScript libraries. Similarly, if you go here, we go to Bootstrap, we go to CSS, and we say bootstrap min.css. We go here, and did it load it? Oh, or is it? Oh, it's thinking. Oh, I'm making poor Visual Studio. Okay. Okay, open with, let's just try opening the unminified version. Okay, this is the unminified version. Anyway, so you can imagine what it looks like minified.
Oh my god.
So this is all styling. Look at all this fun styling. So you might notice that a session demo is a little prettier than the original form demo. This is why it's prettier. We included some fancy CSS. We didn't really do much with the jQuery, but it turns out that Bootstrap needs jQuery. We're not directly using jQuery, but we're using Bootstrap. Bootstrap needs jQuery, so we're including jQuery and Bootstrap. You may go like, what? So the next question is, what the heck are these things? These whack loads of code that I'm loading into my browser. Why am I doing these things? So, let's use our handy-dandy web browser to learn about these things. jQuery. So jQuery's here, and then let's bring up Bootstrap. So first off, Bootstrap, sleek, intuitive, and powerful mobile-first front-end framework for faster and easier web development. So you'll see So basically, this is a set of libraries. It tells you about how to use it, tells you what things when you download it, the template, show the examples, looks at you how things look. And so this is the world of web development. It's all about using the right tools. If you sit there and try to create a beautiful website or even a functional website completely from scratch, you are a fool. Because there is so much code out there, very liberally licensed for you to use. And they have very nice APIs. And so after the midterm, we will talk about how to use some of these things. But right now, I'm just telling you a little bit about the architecture and what it is. So you'll notice that what fundamentally what Bootstrap provides you is lots of cute styling, lots of nice things. But some of that styling also involves changing. Like, for example, responsiveness. Does anyone know what responsive web... Has anyone heard of responsive web design? Okay, yes?
Yeah, so it's... I mean, there's a lot to it, but the biggest part is addressing changes in the browser size with different styles being applied to the elements.
So let me show you a little demonstration here. So this is... I don't know if any of you read Slate. Has anyone read Slate here? Probably not. Maybe some people... So anyway, so this is a U.S. news fun. It's got lots of fun articles and things. But anyway, this is a brand new layout they have. They didn't used to have this layout. And the key thing, they used to have a mobile layout and a desktop layout. Now they just have this layout. And the key thing about it is as you change the screen size, oh, look, it switched to one column. You know, it is. Or now we start making it bigger. Oh, look, it gets multiple columns. And in fact, if I make it big enough, I think I can even get three columns out of it. I don't quite have a... Let me see if I can... Can I do that, actually? Yeah, I think so. Let's see. If I do this... Yeah, see, now I make it big enough, I get three columns. Three columns, two columns, one column. So the idea is if you're on a device with, you know, that's kind of narrow, you'll just get one column view, and the wider your screen is, the more real estate it will take up. Kind of cute, right? Think that takes some code? No. That's called JavaScript magic. There's JavaScript in there that is... So what's actually happening under the hood is you have JavaScript dynamically changing the document. It is generating and changing the layout of the document on the fly. It is using CSS, but it's basically reformatting the page as you do it. Now, it's been organized in such a way so that JavaScript doesn't have to do too much work, but as they say, the document object model is being manipulated when you load the page. This is the current trend in making web pages because it's the best way to make a page that actually looks good on lots of different form factors. Send a program down there and let the program figure out what the form factor is and adapt the layout to it. So, Bootstrap happens to have support for, so that's when they say they have Bootstrap, disable responsiveness. If you don't want your website or application to be scaled on different devices with a little bit of working, disable the responsive features of Bootstrap so that mobile users will see your full desktop site version site. I'm guessing in general you don't want to do this, but you can. So that's why Bootstrap, while Bootstrap, what you include, is pure CSS, it hooks into JavaScript. Now the next question is, what is jQuery? jQuery is part of the infrastructure that makes the web client-side programming not suck so much. It's not a complete cure, but it helps a lot. And the reason why is it's all about browser differences. You know, you're running Internet Explorer, you're running Firefox, you're running Safari, you're running on a touch browser, you're running on a desktop, you're running all these different browser versions. They all have slightly to very different APIs in how to access the the web page. Now, you've all know basics of JavaScript. So that means that the document object model is an object. An object with properties and methods which represents the web page. So if you want to, under programmatic control, change your web page, you want to make a menu animate down, you want to make, you want to make things change colors or something in response to user input, you're doing that by manipulating the document object model. The document object model does not have a uniform API across browsers. It's not uniform in part because some of them do not implement the latest standards, and also in part because some of them just make mistakes. There are quirks. There are bugs in the implementations, and there are various corner cases where things don't quirk right. So what we have is we have libraries, in particular things like jQuery. jQuery is used as the foundational JavaScript library of almost all modern web apps. It's not the only thing you use. There are some other ones, but this is like, I mean, people might want to just throw it in the browser.
If anything, if you were going to use anything to benchmark something, jQuery would probably be it because of its widespread application. It's used just about everywhere. So if jQuery doesn't work on your product, you have problems.
Yeah. That's very true. Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. Yeah, for compatibility testing, if jQuery doesn't know about it, although. So lightweight footprint, only 32K minified, and gzip, also included as an AMD module. I don't know about that, but CSS3 compliant, so this is the latest standard of cascading style sheets, cross-browser. So when you actually access the DOM in a modern web application, you don't call the browser native APIs. You actually call jQuery. And the funny thing is, guess what the name of the jQuery object is in most JavaScript code? Is it jQuery? No, it's $. It's used so much, it gets a one-character name, $. So if you see $ referenced as an object, so dollar dot something or dollar parentheses, it's the jQuery object. Because that got loaded in, and then it's being accessed. So this is the key difference when you talk about client-side versus server-side things. So in Node, you have modules that you include. And when you include the modules, you then can define the name, and then everything's kind of nice. Client-side, you have whatever the browser defined. And whatever else you want to use in terms of code, you have to include it. And so in the header of a web page, what you do, it crashed, right? It's like, where are all my documents? Oh, it crashed. And why didn't it remember what state it had when it crashed? Is that normal for, that's just a little depressing. Anyway, so you go to, so if you go to views, remember there's index.jade. So index.jade always says, okay, block content h1 equals title, so that's your big header. You know, welcome to, you know, the title of your thing. You know, this is all the main stuff you see. But the first part, it says extends layout. And so the idea is you define for all your web pages a standard layout, which is basically defining the header that's going to go at the top of every page. Because you don't need it in each of your templates. And that standard header that you're putting in is layout. And you'll see this layout, it specifies with a doc type 5, HTML, and the body of the page is block content, so that's the stuff that you customize. The header stays the same, and the header specifies things like the title of the page and the things to include. So this is like at the top of a, you know, at the top of our Node program, we include the modules that we need. Instead, with a web page, we have these things in the header that include code, either CSS typically or JavaScript. Now, we don't, because this is the web client, these all these resources have to be accessible on a web server. You're not specifying file names, you're specifying web resources to access. So in other words, these could be complete, these hrefs could be complete URLs. We've made them relative to the current website, so that's why there's only a slash there. We haven't said http://, because it's just assumed to be on our current web server wherever the web application is running, wherever this page was loaded. At that same place, use these relative paths, because we've put them already in our Node web server. It's already sitting there in our public directory. Yeah. Could you, I load jQuery from the jQuery website? Yes. And in fact, there might actually be good reasons to do so, because if you do this and other people do it, then the web browser will cache it. It doesn't have to load it every time. And in fact, there are content distribution networks which will send it around for you. You say, I want this version of jQuery, and they'll get it for you. But what happens when those go down? You get nothing. Your website is down because of some other random web page is being down, not yours. So maybe you just want to go ahead and host it yourself. Since you're running on your local box, you might not be connected to the network. It's certainly nice to have everything local, but this is the kind of trade-offs you do when you use standard components on the web. It's like, do you load it from someone else, or do you load it, you host your own copy? Depends on your situation, but you put additional load on your web server if you include it in your own system, but you know that if your website up, your website is up. So does this all? So how does this all kind of like architecturally feel? I'm trying to get your head around what it means to do JavaScript in the browser versus doing it on the server. So the way what we'll do when we start going to things after the exam, what we will do is you'll create another JavaScript file for client-side code. That JavaScript file will have to be included in this header. And then you'll put that file in public/JavaScript in your Node application. And that JavaScript then will be loaded into your web application on the client side. Yes?
Can you inline JavaScript
in JS? You can. But where would you put it?
One of those?
Yep. Does that sound so much fun? General practice nowadays is to do as little inline JavaScript as possible. What you normally do is there are upcoming security standards such as I should know because I've written papers relating to this, but it's Mozilla's Content Security Policy, CSP. So Mozilla has put out this thing called Content Security Policy, which is for improving the security of web pages in various ways. It has to do with restricting where content can be loaded from. Can you load an image from any website? No, you can only load it from your originating server and other servers that give permission. So there's a Content Security Policy is a pretty cool thing. One of the restrictions of Content Security Policy is that it wants no inline JavaScript. So there are multiple things pushing towards not to put inline JavaScript, including the fact that it makes their program just a pain to understand. So what you'll instead do is you'll just have your general web document, and we'll show you ways to hook in based upon the CSS elements. Because normally the way you specify JavaScript, you just specify JavaScript running on the basis of events, and you just make sure the events, all the objects are defined in your HTML, and then your JavaScript will trigger on them. Yes?
So how can you call the JavaScript on the client from the server?
The basic strategy of this is the server does not call the client. The client calls the server. But as part of the client calling the server, it then it can basically maintain an open connection for back and forth dialogue.
Can the client call itself?
What do you mean, can the client call itself? I mean, it's JavaScript, it's running inside the browser, it can call itself all it's one. It's got lots of functions jumping around.
So say you send like a calculator set of JavaScript the client. There's like a little calculator app in the website. And you enter some numbers and then press like compute. Can you call the JavaScript to compute them?
Yeah, you do that all client side. That JavaScript can all run client-side. You can have JavaScript in your calculator that will evaluate the calculator and do all the fancy math in the browser. Now, if you wanted to call this, now, if you want to make a call to the server, how would you call the server? You're speaking HTTP. The server will see gets and posts. It may be generated by client-side JavaScript, but to the server, it's still a get and a post. And that's... Yeah, we'll talk about how that dialogue is done later on. But you may have JavaScript in the client, you may have JavaScript in the server, but they're talking over HTTP. Now, the basic way you actually exchange things is using JavaScript objects. That's the modern way of doing this. You learn JavaScript objects. JSON is just JavaScript object notation. It's just the JavaScript objects without the rest of the stuff. In other words, curly brace, property, colon, value. That's how you send messages. The server can send JavaScript to the client can send JavaScript to the server. It'll send JSON to the server. That's the communication protocol. If you send it to the server, you send it as part of a post. When it comes down, it just loads it as a file that gets included into the environment. So you'll see this more, but that's the basic model. Remember, that whole model of HTTP connecting the client server doesn't go away. We don't get a side channel. We don't get anything else. It's still HTTP. Yes. Oh, sorry. I thought you had a question. Sorry. No. So this is where, when we talk about client-side JavaScript, this is where it fits in on the server side. We'll stick a link into it in the template. We'll stick it in the public directory so it can be served. And then we put whatever code we want, and that code that we put there will run in the browser in the context of this page, and the data structures it will have access to will be the document object model as parsed by jQuery, as opposed to accessing all those other objects that Node gives you for access, like the request and response and things you get on the server. That's server side. You don't see those at the client. The term for the server and the client communicating bidirectionally, asynchronously, that's AJAX. Although the X is for XML, and that's the old way of the two talking to each other, and nowadays it's more JSON. Okay, I can talk more about this, but I'm, yep.
So jQuery is, that's on the server side only, right?
jQuery is on the client side only. All
right.
jQuery is client-side only.
So jQuery,
the name, is querying the DOM. That's what it's short for. jQuery is JavaScript querying of the document object model.
So like a metaphor is that like jQuery is like the node of the client?
It basically provides your interface. But instead of node is the whole thing, jQuery is a uniform layer on top of all kinds of different browser implementations. I feel like I should probably stop there. I think I've kind of loaded your brains enough. So if you want to stay after, if you have other questions, you can come up to me. Otherwise, you have assignment 2, you have Thanksgiving, and we will talk about answers next Wednesday. Good luck.
Do we have a tutorial on Friday?
Oh, sorry, yes. There is a tutorial Friday.